This is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. Last month, the headlines read like stuff from a science fiction movie. NASA finishes bombing run of the moon. The moon is bombed for water. NASA fires at moon twice. But all of this bombing business was at worst a media creation and at best a poor choice of words. Nothing exploded. No weapons were tested. NASA just trashed and crashed some space junk into the moon, something the U.S. and other countries have done in the past. All in the quest to answer one question. Are there deposits of water ice on the moon? Can we stir up the dust and gravel and dirt or whatever it is down there to see it? Scientists have been analyzing the data from that crash over the last month, and my next guest is here to talk about these first results. Anthony Colaprete is a project scientist and principal investigator for the Lunar Crater Observation and Sensing Satellite, the LCROSS. He's at the Ames Research Center in Moffett Field, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I was watching your news conference today, and there you seem to be saying there was plenty of water on the moon.
Well, there certainly was plenty of water where we were looking.
And that was?
Well, in the ejecta cloud and the vapor plume that came up from our impact in the crater Cabeus, at the south pole of the moon, we can only measure, of course, what we can see in our instruments' fields of view. And in those fields of view, we saw 100-plus kilograms potentially of water.
So that's about 25 gallons, something like that?
Yeah, something like that, right. And I think that's probably a lower limit. As I mentioned, it's only what we can see in our fields of view. What we need to do next is really kind of reconstruct the entire event and almost reverse engineer the impact, stuff what we can see in our instruments back into the ground to really understand the concentration of water in the crater we impacted. Mm-hmm.
So can you speculate whether that would be enough water to support astronauts who might be working on the moon?
It would be speculation, but it's certainly enough water to make that case very interesting. You only need a percent or two to really make the effort worthwhile going there and extracting the water and using it for whatever purposes you would. And I think we're at that level. We're better than the percent level, I suspect. I don't know the exact level, but we're certainly over that threshold.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that this was hidden in a dark crater helped it survive?
Yes. We hit the coldest place pretty much in the crater. It was about minus 220 degrees below zero centigrade. And at those temperatures, all sorts of things can survive in a vacuum and stuffed under the dirt. We excavated probably a meter or two deep, and the crater we made was 20 to 30 meters across, and so fairly large, and unearthed a variety of things, not just water. That's what makes this actually really interesting, that since it is such a cold crater, all kinds of volatiles, in addition to water, have been preserved there.
Such as?
Well, we're still identifying the features that we see in our spectra. So I can give you some of the items we're looking at as potential candidates. They include carbon dioxide, sulfur dioxide, methane, other things like methanol, even things you might find on a comet or a primitive body like an asteroid, an icy asteroid, like a Trojan asteroid or a Centaur asteroid. So it's in hindsight, you know, it's not too surprising that you might see these things alongside the water. Mm-hmm. But we were really excited to see all the other absorption lines and signatures of other species besides the water.
Now, we always talk about amino acids possibly arriving from other places in the solar system. Could you detect that in the sample?
We are certainly going to be looking for it. Hydrocarbons and organics could potentially be contributors to some of the signatures we're seeing. We don't have any kind of positive identification of that right now, but that is what we will be looking for. And both in the ultraviolet and visible spectroscopy that we have of the impact plume, there are a variety of emission lines that we have not identified yet. Some of those may be as a result of organics or other hydrocarbons. We just don't know yet. Yeah.
Did you find any strange minerals, or could you find any that you hadn't seen before?
That is potential. There's the potential for that, too. Right now, we have been really focused on the water. That was our principal goal. I think the entire team is impressed with the data set and the complexity and richness that exists in it. We've identified a number of species that I guess one might expect at the moon, like sodium, for example. There was a large sodium plume that did come up out of the crater after we impacted. And then there's some other identifications that are very tentative right now that are maybe less expected, and we're looking into those. Typical things like potassium and iron, I think we're going to find as we comb through
right.
the data.
If we were to be in that crater and able to walk around, would it feel like we were walking on icy ground there, you know, like in a tundra or something like that?
Well, it didn't look very strong, no. This is something that we're going to, again, try to answer going forward. But the fact that we made a fairly large crater means that the ground was probably not very strong. It didn't have a lot of strength to it. It was probably unconsolidated, maybe fluffy material. So these crystals, if there's a variety of volatiles that are frozen, they aren't necessarily frozen into some kind of hard conglomerate that would feel like walking on tundra or frozen ground. But again, we're talking about concentrations perhaps in the 1%, 2%, 3%, 4% level. And at that level, you still don't quite get as a solidifying of the materials.
Mm-hmm. When the crash occurred, was it strong enough to turn any of that ice into liquid water or vapor, any of that stuff?
It certainly turned it into vapor, and that's the predominant signature we see is water vapor and other vapors. The series of events that, as far as we understand it right now, is that at impact, two plumes occurred, two ejecta plumes. One plume had a high angle, was composed of vapors and fine debris, and it was fairly warm. It was probably about 600 or 700 degrees centigrade, and it rose quickly vertically upward. Some of this vapor reaches high as 20 to 30 to 40 kilometers even. At the same time, a lower altitude, slower moving, more lateral ejecta curtain rose into sunlight and moved much more laterally outward from the impact site. And we see that in the images and in the spectroscopy. And that was debris, dust that got into sunlight and was reflecting back sunlight to us. So that debris cloud got as large as 10, 12, even 15 kilometers across 20 or 30 seconds after impact. And we could see it as long as about 30 or 40 seconds after impact in our cameras, and actually could then actually see the reflectance of material, solar sunlight reflecting off material, as late as 2 minutes after impact. So there's quite extensive cloud that we made around the impact site.
So you had like this low-level smog thing
hanging close
to the ground for a while.
Well, some of that might have been maybe hanging close to the ground, or this higher angle plume that got very high just took a long time to fall back down and basically just kind of rained. There was a continuous raining down of material for 2 or 3 or 4 minutes even after the impact.
Now, are there other areas on the moon that might be as fruitful?
Yes, Cabeas we picked because of its the data right now is really indicating a lot of hydrogen-bearing species there. That's why we went there ultimately. But there are a variety of other places in the South Pole and at the North Pole that show also strong hydrogen concentrations in various instruments. And the two instruments in particular are the neutron spectrometers that flew on. One flew on Lunar Prospector back about 12 years ago, and the current neutron spectrometer on the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is orbiting the moon now. Mm. Both those instruments were really the Lunar Prospector measurements were the ones that really told us something was interesting, really interesting was going on at the poles of the moon, because it showed this increase of hydrogen at the poles, but we didn't know what it was.
Is it possible that anywhere but the poles, if you dig down far enough, you might find the same?
Yeah, it matters. What the dominant physical parameter that probably matters most is temperature.
Right.
And where we hit, it was really cold, so it's a very good trap. But you can find places where it only gets sunlight a few days out of the month, and so is down below the surface, 10 centimeters or 20 centimeters below the surface, it's still below 100 degrees Kelvin or minus 170 degrees centigrade. So in those areas, they're much more extensive than these really cold traps, but they still are cold enough to trap water, for example.
Yeah. And that might be the go if you're going to be permanently based someplace. Those spots might be a place to go.
Much more accessible. You're in sunlight still, and yes, you can extract then material from just below the surface. That's right.
So, what do you do for an encore now?
Well, we've got a lot more data to work through. This was really a status update. There was an incredible amount of interest in the mission, and so we were really compelled to keep people up to date as possible as we went forward. We're working on our current list of publications now on these current findings to get those out, but really identifying everything else we saw in the spectra, identifying all these other materials is really important, and because that actually will help us understand the sources and sinks for this hydrogen. This combined with the earlier measurements from the moon mineralogical mapper on Chandrayaan-1 and the other observations from other spacecraft will really start to put together a new picture of the moon with a water cycle, a hydration cycle, that is active, currently taking place, but also could really harbor some really interesting things that may be a billion years old.
Dr. Colaprete, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Good luck to you. Anthony Colaprete is project scientist for the L-Cross there at Moffett Field at Ames Research Center. We're going to take a break and talk about the solar sail. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News.